This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about advances in cardiac care. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If my heart could talk, it would probably tell me that I take it for granted, that I only pay attention when something is wrong, like when it's beating too fast or too slow. But to Sean Harding, the heart is a marvel of construction.
I think the most fantastic thing about the heart is it's just its reliability. You've got 3 billion heartbeats in a lifetime, 100,000 a day, and you just miss 240 of those, and that's it. So it really has to be absolutely reliable.
Sean is an emeritus professor of cardiac pharmacology at Imperial College London and the author of The Exquisite Machine, The New Science of the Heart. One of the things Sean highlights in the book is that it might feel like the heart is just one organ beating, but really, it's billions of cells beating in synchrony.
So there are individual muscle cells called cardiomyocytes. If you take them out, as I often have, and dissociate the heart, swish it around with enzymes so they all come separate, and you put it into a Petri dish, each one of those will beat like a little heart, beautifully in time. But then when they get together, the real trick is that they're connected to each other all over their surface by electrical connections. And so when the electrical impulse starts at your pacemaker, the pacemaker natural one you have in the heart, then it spreads down the heart in a very controlled way so that the heart beats actually from the bottom upward to push the blood out efficiently. So the bottom contracts somewhat before the top. And so you get a fantastically coordinated beat there.
Sometimes that coordination gets out of whack. For example,
they call this, if you were to open the chest and look in, a bag of worms. It's like squiggly, like a bag of worms. And that's ventricular fibrillation.
A dangerous, irregular heart rhythm that prevents the heart from pumping blood.
And that's why you need the defibrillator to get them all restarted, jumpstart your heart, and so they all start off at the same time. Your heart, when it's in the bag of worms situation, isn't pumping blood because it's not contracting in a coherent way, so you want to get it back into that coherent contraction with the defibrillator.
And what are the worms? Like when you say it's the bag of worms, is it just all the fibers in the heart?
That's right. So some are beating, they're all beating, but they're just beating it in different rhythms and at different times. And so you see them all beating, but not together.
How does the heart communicate with the rest of the body? When we're in distress, our heart beats faster. If we're excited, our heart beats faster. When we're running, obviously, it beats faster to get us more oxygen. But how is all of this connected?
One thing is it's trying to take this away from conscious control. Obviously, you don't want to be thinking about whether your heart's beating or not. You don't want to consciously think about it. So it's an unconscious system called the autonomic nervous system. In fact, if you take your heart out of the body, they will beat by themselves, you know, just lying on the side in the operating theatre when they're waiting, you know, during a transplant operation, they will quietly beat by themselves. So they have that intrinsic power to beat. So what your body is doing is just telling it to beat faster or slower or more strongly or less strongly. And that's this unconscious or what they call autonomic nervous system. You've got the sympathetic nervous system, which speeds it up. That's adrenaline and noradrenaline, its cousin, generally speaking. Another nerve you might have heard of, the vagal nerve, it calms it down again afterwards. And that's your parasympathetic nervous system. And that is sort of yoga thing, using your vagus to calm it all down. And so those two are actually operating at the same time, all the time. Like you've got the accelerator and the brake on in a car. And so that when you need to run, the sympathetic increases, the parasympathetic decreases, and so you've got an extra boost. And so the fight or flight response, when you've seen a saber-toothed tiger or you're jumping out of the way of a bus, your brain doesn't need to think about that. Your body's going to do it without, you know, that's it. Your conscious brain comes in just a little bit later than that. Otherwise, you know, you'd be toast.
Some of the lifestyle changes that we know contribute to heart disease are diet, obviously, exercise, mm-hmm. weight, smoking, drinking, not sleeping. I'm sure we are familiar with those. I wanted to ask a little bit about the role of stress. Is stress really harmful for the heart?
Yes, it is. There's very well documented relationship between work stress and heart disease. The two things that are going on there are a persistent increase in adrenaline. And I noted that adrenaline is great when you get one to get away quickly, but can be a problem if it's too high or it goes on for too long. It can damage the heart. So we have adrenaline and we have cortisol, which will raise blood sugar in a very similar way to diabetes, and so have damaging effects there. And that's a sort of long-term effect. And the statistics are very clear that work stress and other kinds of stress increase the rate of heart attacks. One of the very clear evidence of this is football. I'm talking about English football here, mm-hmm. British football.
But it's
soccer, yes, that's the one. Especially penalty shootouts. So not just playing football, which has some risk, but watching football. And cardiologists know that there will be a spike in heart disease when during a World Cup, especially penalty shootouts. It's something like 30% increase.
So, A, I can really relate to that, being an avid soccer fan. I hate penalty shootouts so much just because of that stress, because it's just like I can almost not bear it. But I imagine that this would affect primarily people who already have some, you know, heart issues, and then that stress kind of puts things over the top.
I think it's probably a bit more widespread than that. You can certainly have apparently healthy, fit people succumbing as well. It's more widespread than that.
Wow. Okay. So even if you're healthy, a really stressful event could have a very serious effect, it sounds like.
Yes. One of the things I've studied quite a lot is something called broken heart syndrome.
Yes.
And that is when in extreme stress, and we're talking about extreme physical stress, somebody falling off a boat and couldn't get back in, for example. And there's extreme emotional stress, like a bereavement. Couples tend to die close to each other, especially elderly couples tend to die close to each other. So you're more likely to die, twice as likely to die in the sort of 3 months after your spouse has died than you are, say, any time the previous year. So that's a real and statistical thing.
There have been a lot of advances in terms of augmenting our hearts through pacemakers that can be implanted and stents that can be used. What are some new developments in that space?
In terms of replacements for the heart, whole artificial hearts have been really quite difficult to nail down in terms of engineering. The race for a complete artificial heart was started at the same time as the space race in the 1960s. And you can see what we've done with the space race, but the whole artificial hearts are still difficult. The partial artificial hearts, which replace just part of the lower part of the heart, have been more successful. There are people walking around with those. They started off as a bridge to when you might get a transplant. And so people have had these for 10, 15 years. The problem is that it's the energy required by the heart. The molecule ATP that gives you your energy for the heart and for everything, in fact, is made from glucose. Now, the amount of energy to keep your heart going for one day, if this ATP wasn't replenished all the time by the reaction, it would be half your body weight of ATP you would need for that. So it's just amazing the amount of kinetic energy you need for the heart. And so you need a battery supply outside the body. You can't get a battery small enough to maintain it. So you have to have a line through your skin. You have to carry a battery around with you, and you have to make sure it's charged up, obviously. If you think it's bad for your phone, you obviously don't want your heart to go down. So what we're looking at here is, can we do anything in terms of battery technology? And there's the idea that you might be able to charge up, just like you lie your phone on a charger without connecting it, you might be able to have that from outside. So you might be able to charge your device from outside your body. They should lie, have a big one of those and lie on it, in effect.
Would it potentially be possible to grow a new heart from stem cells?
So we did a lot of work on this. It's possible, certainly, to grow cardiac muscle cells from stem cells, to turn them into cardiac muscle cells. Not only can we make stem cells into cardiac cells, we can make many of them. Even in my lab, which was not a huge lab, we could make billions in a week without problem. They're also quite good at getting together. If you put them together in a dish, they will join up and they will beat like a sheet of muscle. So making large amounts of cardiac muscle is possible. But this is where the engineering of the heart, you understand how difficult that's going to be. So you can inject large numbers of these cells into a heart that's had a heart attack. And what happens when you get a heart, so we've got up to pig hearts, for example, when you inject those in, what happens is that eventually, after a couple of months, they will merge with the heart tissue and they will be fine. But in between that time, between injecting them in and then merging, you've got them beating by themselves. You've got your heart with it's got one pacemaker, and you get these cells that you've just injected in. They've got another pacemaker. And so the two pacemakers can interfere with each other and produce these kind of dangerous rhythms I've been talking about. So getting over that bit and getting them into the heart without disrupting that engineering is our real challenge now.
Sean Harding is an emeritus professor of cardiac pharmacology at Imperial College London and the author of The Exquisite Machine, The New Science of the Heart.